Welcome to another Glenbrook podcast, and we're still in lockdown. I'm still doing this from my bedroom. It's the quietest room in the house. And following on from David Porter's chat last time, we've now got Nathan Cornish, who is a group board director at Urban Splash. Hello, Nathan.
Good morning, Guy. How are you?
Very good indeed. And just set the scene for us. Where are you calling from today?
I'm at home in my house in Sale. It is actually sun shining. I'm looking in the garden at two very naughty boys causing trouble as usual.
One of our colleagues has got two very naughty boys at home as well, and they're generally digging up the garden. Are you having the same problem?
No, it's the fighting, the unrelenting fighting, which is the main issue. So if you hear any noises, that will just be round five of today's boxing match.
Fantastic. I hope there's no blood or tears at the during this podcast. We were chatting away and we agreed that you should come on this because actually, whilst we've spoken to some agents on residential and we've not really spoken to another developer or property owner during our podcast series. And you and I have known each other for a long time. We'll talk about that. But I thought we'd talk about you and your career, and we're always interested to hear how people have got to where they are in their jobs. So we'll have a chat about your journey. We're going to talk about Urban Splash and the history of the business. It's such a fascinating business and how amazing your marketing and branding is. We're then going to talk about the last recession, if that's okay, and how you guys survived that, because you've been very open about it in the past. And I think it's fascinating, and we got some lessons we can learn about where we are today, applying that. And then modular housing and your house concept. I'd like to have a chat about that. I think that is amazing and what lessons we can learn and how that applies to the current environment. And then where the residential market is and the commercial market is today and how you're getting on as a business and how you think you're set up for the future. So we'll canter through those and we'll see how long it takes. I'm probably around 40 minutes, I suspect, today. But first of all, how on earth did you arrive at such an amazing company? Because you and I met, I remember, I think, when we first met. I was 18. I think you were probably 19. And we met at a house party in Reading, if I recall correctly.
Oh, don't remember that specific meeting. I remember you, though, very, very well, actually, because you were always the clever kid in the year below. And we always used to think, who's this loud, larger-than-life Welsh lads winning our prizes when the third years and second year should win the prizes. And this year, kid the year below us used to win them. I remember one in particular was very, very prominent. It's, my goodness, is that 25 years ago? It must be. Yeah, it must be.
And you did the land management and development course at Reading?
I did, yeah.
And you left that, and where did you go then?
So I went straight to, now called SEGROW, but I got the development graduate position at Slough Estates. So that was really good, actually. I was dead lucky. Don't quite know how I got that, because typically they used to employ sort of, you know, posh lads straight from, you know, either land economy at Cambridge or a few people from Reading. So I managed to talk my way into that job, and it was brilliant, actually. I really, really enjoyed it there. Stayed there for just over 2 years, and then a couple of the directors left Slough and went to run a really interesting company called Savile Gordon Estates, which ended up being by Brixton ultimately. So I went with them. They took me along as a, you know, fairly sort of young, ambitious kid, I suppose, to Savile Gordon. Went, moved up to the Midlands, had a quite an exciting time, but I got a bit, if I'm honest, I got a bit disillusioned by that point with the sort of PLC environment and, you know, this is how you do things, this is how you buy things, this is what we do, this is what we need to give to our shareholders. So after about 5 years at those two companies, I jacked it all in, actually, and went traveling for 14, 15 months, you know, always wanted to do that. And then basically came back and I was either going to do one or two things. I was either going to retrain as a sports journalist or I was going to work for Urban Splash because I'd read about them before I'd left and continued to follow the company whilst I was away. So I came back. And it's quite an interesting story, sort of the recruitment, they were looking for a development manager, development surveyor at the time, so this is 18 years ago. And I'd missed the deadline because I just hadn't got back from Australia in time, so I missed the deadline. And I was a bit, cocky is probably not the word, but I was a bit I thought I might get this job. It just felt right for me. And I missed the deadline with a recruitment consultant. So I phoned him up and said, look, I want to apply for this job. I missed the deadline. So, oh, sorry, you can't apply. And I said, look, I think I'm going to get this job. So you're going to lose your fee if you don't put me forward, because I think I'll get it anyway. So sure enough, I got an interview the next day. And then I met Tom a few weeks later and the rest of the board. And yeah, that was 18, nearly 19 years ago.
So picking up back to Slough Estates, that was the gem job you got pretty much in the development world. There were two jobs I remember on the Milk Round at Reading. It was MEPC and Slough Estates, and you got one of the gem jobs that we all wanted, didn't you, really?
I was dead lucky, yeah. I mean, I went for a few. I didn't do that well in the normal Milk Round to start with, you know, the sort of the JLLs. I remember one particular really excruciating interview at Gerald Eve, which just didn't go well at all for both sides. And I felt a little bit disillusioned, but Slough was the one I really wanted. And I met a guy called John Cogan, I'll never forget him. And he interviewed me, and I just got on with him really well. I didn't fit their normal bracket at all, but got on with them really well. And he said to me, you were the biggest graduate risk, because I just didn't quite know what to make of you. But I really enjoyed it there, and I learned a lot actually, and I still use a lot of some of the systems actually. I've even used some of the systems to this day at Splash.
Well, I think both you and I probably ended up in companies we probably wouldn't normally have ended up in that I didn't really fit in with Grosvenor, even though I was there for many years and you were at Slough for a long time, and they took a risk hiring us both probably, but it's been the foundation of our careers going forward. So I think it's really interesting to hear that. And Segro now, which is the new Slough Estates, as it were, they are the darling of the property industry a bit, aren't they, at the moment?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they weren't when we were there, actually. It always struggled with unsexy industrial, and the share price was always a big problem, and it struggled a bit for identity and things, but it was so active. Everyone thinks of it as an industrial company, but it had a huge office portfolio, and I got to work. Power Station, yes, I own CHP plants. But it was also working with, at the time when I was there, Norman Foster on a building in Ascot and a building on the Bath Road. And you know, working with Norman Foster when you're sort of straight out of school, it was great actually, really good,
phenomenal. And then fast forwarding into your interview with Splash and meeting Tom, tell us about your first impression. So you'd obviously done you'd been tracking Urban Splash, which was a phenomenal company even back then. But tell us about your first meeting with Tom.
I remember he I was sort of waiting, I suppose, semi-nervously in this recruitment agent's office, and Tom came in. I had to do a presentation. I had to talk about how I could add value to the business. And how I could make, I remember the topic, it was how could I make regeneration pay, I think was the topic, which is very open to interpretation. And he sort of, you know, walked in very confident, you know, as usual, with his very long, stereotypical Manchester jacket. Don't think he had a hat on at the time. I think that's been a more latter phenomena. But it was good. And I just immediately felt a connection with the business. I don't really know why, but just that sort of challenging and doing things differently. That was, blatant from meeting Tom, from the chief execs that I'd been used to. He was just totally different.
And what year was this? What year did you arrive at Splash?
I started first week of Jan 2002.
And what did the business look like then? Because I remember us, we sort of lost touch a bit. And then you were getting stuck into Fort Dunlop in Birmingham.
Yeah, the business, I mean, at the time, it felt like I'd been around for ages. And I think it started in 94, so it'd been going about 8 years when I joined. And it was growing, massively. It really was. It was taking on some bigger projects. It was moving out of the Northwest, taking on some bigger projects. And my first day at work, and I sort of always say this, and it's not a joke, is it's the first and the only time I've ever seen Tom wink. But he looked at me, handed me a load of files and said, sort that one out. And I said, is that building on the M6? That building that's been there for about 25 years, Fort Dunlop. And he said, yeah, that's the one. He said, I'll give you a nice easy one to start with. And that was it. And I was sort of, pushed into the office, and off I went.
That is so cool. I mean, I remember the M6 in Birmingham, and I thought that was Birmingham, as a kid growing up and down the M6, Fort Dunlop we always thought was Birmingham. Didn't realise Birmingham was a few miles away from that to a certain extent, or the city centre. Tell us about that project.
Oh, people ask me what their favourite project is, and you never should say which one it is, but it is my favourite, actually. So it's like saying, which one's your favourite kids? Everyone's got one, but you're not allowed to say it. But on Fort Dunlop, it really is my favourite. I mean, it was really interesting. I mean, back to Reading, the first thing I had to do was go and negotiate a grant. And I had to amazingly deal with Mark Beeston's dad, Jim Beeston, who was acting for Adventures West Midlands on it. So you can imagine, so there I was, sat there, didn't really know what I was doing. I'd been in the job 3, 4, 5 months, and I was trying to negotiate a multi-million-pound grant with a really good mate of mine's dad. It was just bizarre, to say the least. But it was one of the first things we did, actually, is we negotiated an additional piece of land from AWM. We managed to get a £10.2 million grant. I mean, that sounds big, but the overall project cost of 50-odd million quid, so it was only 20% intervention on it. But we had this sort of idea, really, is that let's try and make it a vertical business park. There's a lot of sort of Birmingham Business Park, a lot of sort of stuff on the outskirts of Birmingham, which, you know, we thought we could compete with if we had an interesting product. So went out there, we handpicked a few, a coffee shop, gallery, you know, nursery, sort of created all the ground floor ingredients, I suppose, for a place, nice place to work, and then worked with Shed KM on the design and started doing it on a phase basis. Now, each floor there was 50,000 square foot net, and there were seven floors, and then so we had to go out and do that. So it was pretty ballsy. But the first pre-let we did was actually the hotel, and that's now a very iconic kind of big blue wedge that slices into the building. And that was Travelodge. And some said, yeah, it's not the sexiest of brands, I suppose, Travelodge, to work with us. But I can't tell you how important it was that we did that pre-let and we got building on site, because the message that gave to the Birmingham market, who were very, very naturally and understandably sceptical about the project because it had so many false dawns. The Richardson brothers had it, and a few others had had it over the years. And the message when you started cranes, you know, lifting pods in for this new hotel, and this really interesting kind of, you know, blue wedge crashing into this icon, was just such huge moves. And then it just sort of went from there, really. And I remember we employed a lady called Emily, who's still with us, actually, Emily Hanslip from DTZ, as our lettings manager on the ground. And, you know, she was, after a, you know, sort of slow start, we were getting periods where we were letting more space in that building than the CBD in Birmingham in a couple of consecutive quarters. It was just phenomenal, phenomenal project. And, you know, we just hit it at the right time.
And you were based down in the Midlands then, I presume. You weren't based in Manchester?
No, I was living in Manchester, but a lot of people think, okay. I had a very, very strict routine of Monday, Tuesday, stay over Monday night in Birmingham and work there Thursday. So Monday, Tuesday, Thursday was my Birmingham days, and Wednesday, Friday were my Manchester days. It was a very strict diary. But of course, we took on the Rotunda at the same time. So there I was, sort of dealing with, you know, probably two of the, you know, most iconic buildings there, I say, in Birmingham. Yeah. Same time. And the Rotunda was a totally different project, but also really, you know, flattering and, you know, wonderful projects to work on, to be honest.
Yeah, phenomenal. I remember going around the Rotunda when we were at Reading. We went around it as a vacant building and we're taken around it. Not sure whether Splash owned it then, but pretty phenomenal that the opportunity to work on both of those. So fast forward a tiny bit then to the crash 2008-2009, and talk about Splash, because you guys were so adventurous in what you were doing and ambitious and doing amazing projects. It must have come as a challenge when things, viability was challenging in the good days, even, you know, regeneration projects, you said earlier, it's hard to make them viable in the first place. But when the crash came, it must have been pretty challenging.
Yeah, I mean, it's very well documented. It hit us very, very hard. We were incredibly exposed. I mean, I think, you know, the Splash is owned and continues to be owned by, you know, by its directors. There's no external shareholding in the main business. And, you know, it typically funded projects, you know, very, very simply with debt and its own equity. It's a very, very simple model. Yeah. We had 800 homes under construction, typically in, I think they were in four or five apartment schemes, all of which were roughly between a third and two thirds of the way completed. And then we had four standard, you know, high street banks not wanting necessarily to lend against those anymore. And we had, you know, we'd drawn, you know, tens of millions of pounds worth of debt against those projects. So, you know, that coupled with a commercial portfolio that had, you know, fairly recently been re-geared and missed its covenants quite quickly as soon as the market started to crash there. We were, you know, and then obviously all of the purchases where we had completed projects didn't want to purchase anymore. So we were just hit from all angles, quite frankly, you know, like many others were. And it was tough.
The openness, though, I was impressed with how open the company was, you know, and I think I worked for a company that was very open as well at the same time about the challenges of the recession. Do you think there's something to be learned from being open? Do you think that held you in a good place as you came out of the recession?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We talked to everybody, and yeah, you know, we openly said. I mean, I think what we were doing and what we still do is generally, you know, good design, good quality. We believe in what we're doing, and you know, we're genuinely into place and the local community. So I think a lot of people, you know, wanted to see us survive, and that's both from our, you know, banks. You know, HSBC and Co-op were both incredibly supportive throughout the process, but also, you know, the government as well. And you know, one of the things that helped us, very open about it, was the Kickstart funding that came through, yeah, through Homes England, and that was a real lifeline for us, because what that managed to give us the debt to, you know, finish the project, but it also encouraged the banks that had already lent these tens of millions on these projects to lend a bit more. So it wasn't just all Homes England Kickstart. It was, you know, it was the banks were encouraged also to finish off the projects, and we finished every project that we started. I mean, and it was very, very difficult. Mm. I always say you can judge us on the quality of our projects that we finished during the recession, because we absolutely refused to compromise, even though we were halfway through many of them. We absolutely refused to compromise on quality, even though there was clearly pressures to save money as where we could. But that was a really big thing for us, that we didn't want to dilute the brand and quality, because, you know, people were buying these products and it was important that they got what they thought they were getting. And when we come to sell them, it was important that we, you know, we maintain that quality.
So that's interesting to see how you guys got through the very dark days, but you rebuilt it really quite quickly and into something different, or picking up on where the world had moved on to now. So tell us a bit about where Splash is today, and how you're prepared really for the challenges we've got ahead.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that got us going again on new developments was one of the things we did during the recession was we sold, we had a lot of apartments, hundreds, that's about 800 actually, and we sold them in a deal to Places for People, you know, the biggest housing association in the country. Yeah. And as part of that deal, we sort of realised there was a lot of shared values and you know, a lot of shared goals and things. So we set up a joint venture company, and we started developing with them, and that joint venture is still going now and is very active. So that got us, you know, straight back into sort of development again. So that was good. We also got a joint venture with Pears that we continue to own a section of our commercial portfolio with. So we've started aligning with, you know, strong partners, really, where our ambition is unrelenting, but we were aligning ourselves with people that, you know, could help us deliver that ambition. And then sort of the most recent joint venture, I suppose, that we've which is a year old, I think today or tomorrow, actually, I think it's tomorrow actually, as a year anniversary, was the Secretary House joint venture, where we effectively demerged the housing side of the business, and Sekisiri took a 35% stake, along with Homes England took a 5% stake, and a few others as well. So, yeah, we've come out of the recession. We've aligned ourselves with really, really interesting quality partners, and that's the sort of the model that we've been using. Albeit we do still develop directly. We've got a few projects on directly as well, 100% within our existing development business.
And your Homes England relationship that you built during the sort of darker days is a really strong relationship now, and you're one of the sort of lead partners with Homes England, is that right?
Yeah, they. I mean, what we're more by luck than judgment, I think. But they absolutely are into quality. They're into placemaking, and they're really, really pushing the MMC market. And we've been quite lucky, really, is that we got into doing modular housing with our first house scheme probably 7 years ago now at New Islington when we first started on that scheme. So when we came to complete that first phase, that was when the noises that the government wanted to get behind, you know, following the sort of farmer report and all the rest of the different things, is that the government really wanted to get behind MMC. Now, we were already entrenched in it. You know, we'd done it. We were working with SIG, who were the factory owners at the time. And yeah, the timing just sort of aligned perfectly, really, is that, you know, her government agency that wanted to invest in MMC technology. You had Secretary of House, the world's largest house builder, build all of their houses in factories in Japan, wanted to invest in the UK, and you had us doing it already on a variety of sites across the northwest, and looking to expand. So it was, you know, not a perfect marriage. Nothing's ever perfect, but there were three things all aligning at the same time there.
Has the modular experience been a good one? I mean, when you first did your New Islington scheme, I mean, I went around and it's phenomenal. You should definitely go and have a look at it. Was it a good experience, or has it been a steep learning curve and you've amended the business model as you've gone along?
Yeah, I mean, it's the first thing I'd say to anybody, and I say this quite openly, is, you know, modular is not for the faint-hearted. If I hear another developer saying, "Oh, I'm going to build off-site in a factory because I'm going to save money and I'm going to save time on one project," and they're sadly, I think, sadly misguided. You've got to think long term. It's, you know, you've got to. In our case, we actually ended up effectively taking over the factory from Sheffield Insulation Group about 2 years ago. So you know, there's an overhead to carry. There's a lot of, you know, staff to carry. So there's lots of things to think about. But we believe that, you know, the construction market needs MMC, and in our case, you know, sort of modular through our factory, is that the construction market does need, you know, a different way of doing things. Now, it's not instead of, it's as well as. And you know, we think we're onto something. But as I said, it's, you know, it's you learn. We're continually learning. The day you're not learning, and obviously with the Secretary of House, these guys are doing it. You know, they do 40,000 homes a year in Japan. And
What changes have they brought, Nathan?
Well, the first thing they've done is they've brought five people over full time. So they're not just a passive investor. So there's five people full time. We're working with them on new products. They're helping us bring efficiencies into the factory. Yeah, they're all over it, really. You know, it's we don't want them also to be a passive investor. We want to learn from them as much as they'll learn from us. And yeah, it's very, very interesting, actually. The you know, the get tying that all into the business and getting it all integrated. It's not without challenge, as always, but so far so good.
And is just a very pertinent question given the current lockdown, is modular construction social distancing friendly in the sense of a lot of our, well, certainly our house building sites have closed down temporarily. Are you able to keep the factory going at the moment because of social distancing rules?
No, we made the decision a week or so before the you know, the sort of the full lockdown in the UK. I mean, albeit some contracts have carried on, but we made a decision a bit before that we weren't confident from a, you know, health and safety point of view, social distancing point of view, that our sites were fully safe. So no, we closed the factory, and I think we're on site with 13 different sites across the country. So we made those decisions to close down where we were the main contractor. And the factory being a big one. Now, the plan is that we're going to reopen those in a few days, 10 days or so, with a whole set of policies in place. And so yeah, we weren't confident at the time, but yeah, we are more confident now we can apply those rules. But we've got to be very, very strict, and you know, have a quite stringent red yellow card system, that if people are not complying with the rules, then we've got to get them off site, basically. So, and time will tell how that works. I think we're all going into the unknown on this one.
Oh,
And we'll
tell
give
me
it
now.
a
Tell us about it. And Splash was sort of formed back in the early days around commercial property, wasn't it, to a certain extent in Liverpool? You've still got quite a bit of commercial property now?
Yeah, I've got about, I think, last count, about 1.4 million square feet. So it's a fair chunk of our portfolio, and we manage all that ourselves as well. So yeah, it's a big part of what I do, to be honest. I get very involved in that side of the business, as well as sort of the new sites and things. And it's you know, it's in some ways been the most successful part of our business, because you know we've always managed them well, and we've managed to sort of keep the space updated, because I think the market's changed a lot in the last 3 years on the commercial side.
Mm. There's a great video, isn't there? Tom did a piece to TV in the mid-90s when he was talking about his shops in Liverpool up in the rope walks. And I always remember those shops. I think, do you still own those shops in Liverpool?
Yeah, I think that might have been Slater Street. We actually sold that a couple of years ago. But yeah, it's quite active, the portfolio. We traded a lot, actually. We sold Fort Dunlop five years ago. You know, we sort of, you know, buy and sell quite quickly. What we're particularly good at on the commercial side is that when we find something that we like, we can move really, really quickly. We've got a team that's very sort of nimble. We bought the boat shed with Pears, actually, in 5 days from agreeing. Wow. This is from agreeing the deal to completing in 5 days. And we had to set up a JV company with Pears. So you can imagine that was a quite intense week. But we're able to do that because we're quite nimble on the commercial side and move pretty quickly.
And so today, where we are today in the current market, how are you fixed for the current challenges? I mean, I talk to a lot of people, and residential seems to be really at the heart of a lot of people's strategy going forward. You've got a range of strategic land, I think, and residential in suburban locations and city centre locations. Where do you see the market sort of evolving from where we are today?
Well, the reality of it is, I mean, take COVID out for a second. The reality of it is we aren't building enough homes, and I don't think that's going to stop in terms of, I don't think we're going to catch up anytime soon. I think the underlying demand is there. There's a massive issue with build costs. That's a continually difficult conundrum to crack for all of us, I think, especially to deliver quality product. I think where we are, I think because we're from Manchester and we're doing, people who are in Manchester, I don't think people quite realise how many, sites we're on site with. I mean, we're on site in Sheffield, we've got stuff in Plymouth that we're on site with, we're going to be cracking on soon in Cambridge, Liverpool, over at the Wirral. You know, so we're doing stuff all over the country, quite literally. We think that the underlying market and demographics of the residential is good. We think that our products will go down well in the right areas, where we're offering choice for consumer to build their own, effectively internally design their own homes. So yeah, we once this is over, and I think sort of, what this means, I don't think anyone's quite sure really. I think it is such a difficult time to get your heads around. But yeah, once it's all over, our ambitions will be the same really, and that we want to deliver quality homes across the country and build ourselves up into at least a medium-sized house builder.
So two other things, Nathan. I think one of the things I'm always fascinated about, because we're looking at Birmingham more and more, and I think there's a big argument in London whether Birmingham is the second city or Manchester, is a gargantuan scheme you have down there. Tell us about IPL.
Yeah, well, it's funny enough, it's going back to some of the stuff we talked about earlier. When we were doing Fort Dunlop and Rotunda, I was on that train going down, and I was always looking on my right-hand shoulder when we were coming into New Street, and this Port Loop site, as we call it, now it just intrigued me, and I've been trying to buy it, honestly, Guy. I've been trying to buy it for about 10, maybe 15 years. I'm failing, because it was in mixed ownership. I think AWN had a slice, the City Council had a slice, Canals and Rivers Trust had a slice, and I think there were some private ownerships as well. So it was always complicated. And then probably 4 years ago or so now, the Canals and Rivers Trust and Birmingham City Council got together, amalgamated their parcels, and had a developer competition. And it was a tough one to win, but we went in with Places for People. We had a I guess, a compelling proposition. And we were lucky enough to be selected and honoured to be selected. And it's a big site. It's 43 acres, and I can't think of another site that close to a city centre in any other of the, you know, major cities. And what's great about it is it's right next to Edgbaston Reservoir, but moreover, it's got a sort of canal intertwining all the way through it that creates, in the heart of the site, an incredible island, which has basically got a canal on all sides. It really is quite wonderful. So yeah, we're really up for it, and it's dead exciting.
And what are your plans? Is it modular, or is it high rise residential? What's your plans for the site?
A mix. I mean, I think the other thing to say really on the modular, our housing is not just modular. It is just one product from our range. So we're doing other stuff as well. That's MMC, but not necessarily coming out of the factory. But yeah, so it's a mix. So we're now on phase three. So first phase was 43 modular homes. The second phase, which is on site now, is a more traditionally built brick house, as we call it, which is designed by Glen House. And then the third phase, which we're just about to crack on with, consists of Mansion House, which is our cross-laminated timber apartment block. There's going to be two further, what we call corner houses, which are a new sort of apartment typology, which we want to bring into the range, and then some further modular and brick houses. So it's a mix of stuff down there, and we're cracking on. We're within sort of last 14 months or so, we started on three sites.
I think it's amazing, and I think it's a real point of difference in Birmingham. I think the Birmingham market is very complicated. I think in comparison to Manchester, it's another level again in terms of complexity, in terms of the quality and points of entry into the market. It's a very complex market, I think, and I think we're sometimes lucky in Manchester that we've got a reasonably simple market. I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, Birmingham. I always find Birmingham quite puzzling because it sort of seems to lag behind Manchester at the first wave of a boom, and then sort of accelerates through, and values, certainly in the last cycle, values actually was starting to exceed Manchester's values towards the end of the cycle. So that may well be the case now. But yeah, I always found with Birmingham it lacks lacks that kind of homegrown. I mean, it's got some now, but that's like sort of homegrown entrepreneurial type developers. It's got a lot of the big boys in there. But yeah, it's and I always find it quite weird that sort of, you know, Manchester based developer were doing Fort and the Rotunda, really. I thought you know, sort of maybe more of a homegrown type of developer.
It suffers massively also from London going in there and speculating. And I think because it's the first, you know, it's like an hour on the train or whatever from London, I think it suffers from people going up with lots of money, buying sites and speculating and not delivering. And I think that's been the blight of the market in the last cycle or the current cycle, because delivery has not happened like it has happened in Manchester.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about it is, I love it. I love the place. I mean, it's got a reputation, but like most places, once you actually get to know it, it's got loads about it. I mean, you know, some of the canal infrastructure and just the places and in it are great. And it's a place that we've always done a lot of business in, and we plan to do a lot of it in the future.
So two final questions. The next one doesn't have to be a long answer, because I don't know if we know the answer, but with COVID-19 changing the world at the moment, what impact will it have on the housing market? And with that specifically, I mean, do you think city centre living will be, people will turn away from city centres and go to live in suburbia where there's more space? Or do you think city centre high-rise living will be sustained in its current form?
Wow, that's some question. I think, do you know, I was thinking about this the last few days, actually. It's like, with the 2008 credit crunch, everyone understood why it was happening. And there was a fundamental issue with debt in the market. And, we'd all use probably too much of it, ourselves included, by the way. I think with this one, it's quite hard to sort of understand it, because you can't even see it, let alone try and work out what effect it's going to have. I think, as I said before, the underlying residential sort of indicators are strong. And I think city centres, you know, will continue to be very, very, very strong. I mean, Manchester's, you know, probably the leading example of it. It's a great place to live. And, you know, I do wonder, though, whether it will have knock-on effects like demands for more green spaces in Manchester, because I think that's one thing the city centre does lack, is that where are the big green spaces? I mean, we've done a bit of that at New Islington, but, you know, there might be more call for that. I'm a long-term, and this will get me into trouble, but I'm a long-term advocate of pedestrianising much more of the city centre. All of Deansgate, for instance, that could be an incredible green lung all the way down the centre of town. I think it could be amazing. So I think the calls for, you know, how people experience city centre in terms of walking, cycling, hopefully that will really, really get pushed on. I do think there will be some certainly short-term reticence about going on, you know, public transport. I do understand that. So yeah, I think it might be the way we do things. What knock-on effect that has to demand for property, I don't know, is the honest answer. I think commercial market's dead interesting, because what we're all experiencing is, well, we all know how to use Skype and Zoom and, you know, all the different things now. I think I was probably guilty before of not, you know, using them as much as I should have done. And I'm going to really think now about getting on the train for a 2-hour meeting in Milton Keynes or London or whatever. I'm going to really think hard about that now. Do I really need to do that? So yeah, there's going to be some real knock-on effects. But I think the underlying reasons for living in city centre, I don't think will change massively. And I think that it'll only increase over time. Because I always, I'm long answer this one, but I always think about this in terms of, if you look at the conurbation in Manchester, and depending on, you know, where you draw the line, but let's just say it's 3 million. The city centre population is still a minute percentage in terms of the overall conurbation area. And I just think that, you know, it is a great place to live.
The most exciting thing you said there for me is the sort of pedestrianisation of Deansgate. I'm a big car man, as you know, and drive in, but actually, having gone into town once during the lockdown to get some papers signed and take the solicitors, I saw Deansgate empty, and actually could see for once the vision of that being a green boulevard that ran the length and the heart through the heart of the city. I think we should get Glenn Howells on that and have a look what he could do with it.
I did the same thing. I went for a run actually, and I went through the city centre, and you kind of think it's going to be quiet and stuff, but I was gobsmacked. I went through all of the major squares, and I probably saw five people, and it was amazing.
It's spine tingling, isn't it? So the final question, and to close this off, really, I've got this vision now of you as, you know, an urban dweller, wealthy developer, but with a high, strong interest in design. So I'm visioning where you might live. Do you want to tell us what the reality is?
So you got a lot of that wrong in that intro there. So where do I live? Well, I used to live in a very cool, funky, urban splash flat in town. But in 2010, I bought a bungalow, actually, with my Mrs. Ange.
A bungalow
in Sale. I mean, you couldn't probably have to like least sexy words put together. They just don't work at all, do they? But I actually looked at it, and we've been looking for some time about, you know, I wanted a project. And actually looked at the floor plan, and bungalows, like, typically it's got the connotation of it's where old people go to die. But if you actually look at the floor plan of a bungalow, and then you look at a city centre cool loft apartment, the floor plan's almost identical. So therefore it can't be the property, it must be the image of it. So I got quite intrigued by this, because originally we bought a site, we thought we were gonna knock it down and build a new build, but I got completely transfixed by the idea of doing a cool bungalow. So phase one, which we finished in 2012, I used a really interesting, and check them out actually, a young architect's practice called Blee Halligan, and they did an interesting extension, which is three kind of wings that sort of crash into the existing bungalow. They're sort of quite alien, deliberately quite alien. And then last year we've sort of finished sort of phase two, and we put a new roof on the bungalow and sort of inhabited the roof space. So it's either a house now or a bungalow on steroids. I'm not quite sure which it is, but yeah, we've had some fun with it. But you know, we love it, and it's amazing what you can do with, you know. And we got published an article in the Wall Street Journal actually about it. It's called A British Bungalow Reborn, which was
really
lovely. Yeah, I sort of tried to keep it quite quiet, but you know, although I shouldn't really be saying it now on the
radio. We'll all be Googling that now.
Yeah, I can't talk about design quality and great architects all day and not practice what I preach. You know, you've got to live what you breathe, really.
Well, that's fascinating. I didn't know that. So, yeah, that's great. I'll be off and Googling later. Well, Nathan, thank you very much for being so open and sharing so much with us. I've learned, even though I've known you for many years, I've learned a lot there. And hopefully a number of our listeners will. And we think you're doing a great job. We hope you're stronger than ever in terms of the challenges. I think your variety of your business will stand you in good stead. And we're excited to see what you have lined up next. So thank you very much for spending what has been 45 minutes or so with us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for asking us.
Thanks very much, Nathan. Bye-bye.
Cheers.